Mysterious Universe, Season 18, Episode 12. Coming up on this show, we've got encounters with the past at 45 speed, the secret organization founded by the Golden Buddha, and the 14th century robot Tulpa. I'm Benjamin Grundy. Joining me is Aaron Wright.
I tell a lie. It's not really founded. It's more that the Golden Buddha was found. Then, of course, you end up with Black Ops projects. So, you know, I'll fill you in as to how we get from point A to point B later in the show.
I like how your hair looks like you've just stuck your finger in an electrical socket.
Oh.
Your eyes are all bloodshot. You look like you've smoked maybe 1,000 cigarettes.
It's been one of those days where, remember how I did the segment about the Federal Reserve and the possibility of the Titanic being sunk so it could be founded?
Aaron's conspiracy hour coming up.
Yeah, there's a bit of an Aaron conspiracy quarter coming up because I ended up reading Gold Warriors, America's Secret Recovery of Yamashita's Gold.
Yeah, you're welcome.
No, welcome at all. That was terrible.
It was a trap.
It was a trap because you send me this book and you go, oh, just thumb through it and maybe you could just do like a little segment on it. And I ended up spending 2.5 days going through this book trying
to... He had to sleep in the office.
It was just crazy. It's an absolutely crazy, incredible story. And at first I'm thinking this is completely unbelievable. But the more that you look at it and the more that you start looking at the evidence... You start going, maybe there's something to this. And it actually might explain why, for example, when Snowden released all those documents, it turns out that there's $52 billion a year that's spent on Black Ops projects that doesn't come from government revenue or anywhere else.
Well, if you missed last week, all of this extends off from the end of the free show last week where we were talking about the legend of Yamashita's Gold, and it's allegedly a true story as far as I know, but you're going to fill us in on this, of a hoard of gold and jewels and antiquities and art and, you know, rare artifacts.
Everything you can imagine.
That was basically plundered by Japan during World War II throughout all of Asia, through China and Korea and Southeast Asia. They took it all to the Philippines under this secret project. It was codenamed Golden Lily,
Golden
right?
Lily, yes.
And they built these massive underground complexes to hide all this gold. And that's as far as I'm going to say, because I know that you've got this huge segment planned coming up. So are we going to hear some of this in the free show?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about the Golden Buddha and this Buddha that was found in one of these alleged vaults and how it led essentially to the implementation of martial law and the downfall of the president of the Philippines. So it's just this really, and you know, we've got some psychics thrown in there, a little bit of esotericism. Yeah, it's just, it's a very, very strange story. I mean, the guy was a quack, but still, it's still a very strange story.
Is there hidden entrances to underground bases?
Well, they're still there. This is a thing. So there are 172 alleged vaults, or 175, but somewhere in that range of these vaults are allegedly built all across the Philippines. Some of them built in such a way that they are completely hidden, perfectly hidden, and they still haven't been uncovered. So plenty have been plundered, and that explains where a lot of this funding has come from with the Black Eagle Trust, which is a trust that was established essentially by the global elites afterwards.
You're starting to do it.
You're starting to connect the dots. No.
You should see his hands going. He's connecting all these dots that are floating in front of him that none of us can see.
See, the problem is today is that, if you've been listening to the show for a while, I don't buy into conspiracy theories apart from, I undercovered the Federal Reserve stuff, but that was just for shits and giggles. It was just fun. Yeah. But now I'm starting to understand or starting to realize that maybe the world is not the way we perceive it. And I know that you should never believe anything that you read on the internet or in the newspapers or anywhere else. You've got to use your own noggin to get that information. But at the same time, I'm starting to see that basically there's a hidden hand behind practically everything you could possibly imagine that's happened in history. And it's still ongoing now. We're not being told the truth. And I find that really scary. So I'll present the evidence later in the show and then you can work out what you think about it.
And when's your new show on InfoWars starting?
I know. No, I need to be a little bit more. I mean, I know I'm angry already, but I need to be more angry to get to that level.
I see that your male vitality is back after getting over the health scare. It's good to have you back, buddy.
Thank you. And thank you to everyone who sent in emails and tweets and everything else. I got the all clear. Yep. I got discharged from cardiac care. So that was, they couldn't work out what the hell was wrong. But apparently I'm fighting fit.
Your heart is 110%.
Apparently I'm fine.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, the day before you were getting your results, I walked into Aaron's office and I asked him, well, I wanted to make a bet with you. I basically bet Aaron. I said, look, I bet you're going to be fine. I bet you $10, just a fun bet, you're going to be 100% fine, because I was confident everything was going to be okay. and you took the bet against yourself. You're like, fine, I'll take that bet.
No,
I bet you $10 I'm going to die.
Seriously, when you're having palpitations and you feel like hell, it really makes you go, okay, I'm in trouble. And of course, you know.
But why would you bet against yourself?
Do you know what's
You really, want to be positive.
Yeah, I know. But it was just, it was a pretty terrifying experience. And I must say, though, that kind of leads into this theme of the show, because when you start realizing potentially, of course I wasn't, but when you start, you know, having these symptoms and there's little scares and whatever else going on and there's all outstanding tests, I started going, what do I really think about reincarnation and past lives? And I'm thinking, what is beyond this veil of mortality? What happens when we cross over to the other side? And as I was doing that, I happened to have all these books I'd just ordered just on a whim that have come in, and one of them focuses on past life regressions, and it happened to have an LP in it.
Nice segue. This is Encounters with the Past, How Man Can Experience and Relive History. It's by Peter Moss with Joe Keaton. Joe Keaton's the hypnotist who regresses people, and Peter Moss is the author, but also the investigative journalist who's kind of skeptically approaching this topic.
Which is good.
And you're right, this is a really obscure book. I don't know how you even found it. There's hardly even an Amazon page for the thing. And on the Amazon page, it doesn't even have a cover on it. But you're right, this book came in and we opened it up and two vinyl LPs fell out. Brand new condition, like untouched.
Yeah, brand new.
No one's ever played them before. And, well, since we didn't have a turntable, we thought, oh, good.
We've got to go. We didn't even have a CD player.
Buy a new piece of equipment. So we did that. We went to the store and we got a record player. We got a turntable because we wanted to see what was on these records. And it's the voices, it's the regression sessions of the people that have been taken under and taken back to their past lives. Now, before I play you some of those, because some of them were actually quite good, I want to set the scene for you, because in the prologue, Peter talks about working with Joe, and he starts talking about one of the first regressions he ever saw Joe Keaton working on. And seven of these cases are covered in the books. There's not that many cases. But he says it's the early disturbing moments of a first regression. The subject, an intelligent and articulate woman of 23, has been through all the preliminary stages of hypnosis and now in the deepest state of all, is told to go back to before her birth to search out a memory in the immensity of time. For some 20 seconds, he says, she remains limp, inert, almost as if she has just died. An almost imperceptible alertness, which one cannot quite define, starts to flow through the passive face and figure as if new life was suffusing through a corpse. So this is really what the book is like. He's describing the little movements that the person will make, or the change in the atmosphere, or they might lick their lips, or their eyelids will flutter, or something will happen, and it's usually a signal that they're about to
venture
somewhere else. And Keaton asks, what's your name? My name's Joe. What is yours? The woman faintly says, and this is a problem with all these regressions, is in the first sessions, there seems to be a disconnect between the personality that's trying to come through, or the memories, if you want to call it that, and the conscious mind of the current person.
Well, that kind of filtering it, do you think? Or
it's almost like...
Or battling?
Well, they make the case that, say someone regresses to 17th century Europe. And it's in England. The English they use will be almost incomprehensible to us today.
Oh, of course. Yes.
So this has been, I guess, ammunition for skeptics to say that none of these memories are real, because the person coming through should speak using the terminology of their time.
Ye olde English.
But you can tell there's a kind of struggle. And this is what Keaton and Moss argue in the book, is that there's this connection that needs to be made between our conscious mind that we've formed in this life and our set of vocabulary.
Yeah, right.
And whatever the memories are from this previous existence somehow has to merge and filter through.
Well, it makes sense, because whatever ego exists at the moment, it's still sitting in this vessel. And if you've got that previous ego coming through, it's still having to somehow mediate with the current ego, right? Yeah.
But all of this makes it very, very monotonous and difficult in these early sessions. But he persists. And the hypnotist Joe says, well, never mind, how old are you? And the woman faintly says, I am nigh my 18th year.
Oh.
He says, my name is Joe. What is yours? I would like to know. I am the daughter of Mother Waterhouse. Where do you live? And very softly she says, Hadfield. What's your first name? He asks. My name is Joan. What is the matter, Joan? Why do you stroke your hair like that? Because she's starting to get agitated. Are you married, Joan? No, she says. Are many boys paying court to you? And she cackles with laughter. Why do you laugh? Why do you laugh? What are you doing at this very moment? And then she gets overcome with fright. And she's saying, I am at the assizes. And the assizes would be like the court.
Okay.
So she's in court. What are you doing there? Joe asks. We'll try to help you if you can. Tis too late. Tis my mother, sire. What about your mother, Joan? And this woman that's on the hypnotist's couch in his office spits into the room, just hocks up a massive loogie and spits and sighs deeply saying, it's because of her I am here. What are you accused of? Witchery.
Oh.
And he goes on to explain that for the next 20 minutes, with this growing terror in this woman, she starts talking about the trial of Chelmsford Assizes. She gives the year 1556. She gives the name of her prosecutor, a Gerard. She gives the name of the fellow accused. And she describes the humiliation of being, going through this trial of witchcraft. And all the details match up. They go through the history records.
So they can be verified.
They find the records of the court case. They find the records of the prosecutor. It's all in there. She describes all these details, and eventually in the regression, she's screaming out, I know not Satan. I know not Satan. She's screaming it at the top of her lungs. And this is where Keaton has to kind of bring her back, bring her out of this experience. And you know, this is one of the first times that the author, Moss, has actually seen this. And by this stage, he's saying, look, there's no doubt that the emotions she's feeling are utterly real.
Mm.
And she's actually experiencing, in a physical and mental sense, the pain, the frustration, the bitterness, and the terrors that must have racked the original Joan Waterhouse, who was the identity that they eventually trace this to. This was 4 centuries earlier. So the book is quite good at finding these little confirmations of evidence that the person that's coming through was a real individual. They can't do it in all 7 cases, but in some cases they can. As I was going through this, you get a sense of just how competent the hypnotist is, Joe Keaton, and how seriously he takes this. But then I wanted to introduce to you some of the recordings we got from these vinyl records, so you can really get a sense of the emotions that these people go through when they allegedly relive these past lives. So we bought our brand new turntable, we put on the first record, not knowing what to expect, and this is what came through. Let's take a listen.
It's the opening moments of a first regression. A very intelligent but skeptical subject has been told to go back before her birth to find a memory in the vastness of time. These are her first words.
What's the matter? What's your name?
Can you understand us? Are you ill?
Are you ill?
Fire.
Fire? Mm-hmm. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
So that was pretty intense.
Wow. I mean, even when I heard that the other day, even just listening back to that now, I've got goosebumps. That's a really disturbing and visceral experience.
That's this English housewife, Sue Atkins, and she's describing reliving the life of a young boy named Charlie who perishes in a fire. I might actually play you some more of this audio because her experiences are featured and kind of explained in more detail. Let's take a listen.
Sue Atkins, who was heard in the first extract, regressed to 2 main characters, both of them male. The first was Charlie, a gutter-sharp, blasphemous urchin at the beginning of the 20th century. Here's Charlie with some cynical comments as he describes how he used to beg outside the church.
I don't beg when they're going in, it's no good.
When do you beg?
When they're coming out.
When they're coming out?
Because the vicar's watching them, you see, when they're coming out.
Oh, I see.
And they're all going back to their goose and their chickens and things. The vicar's going back to his goose.
What type of church is it?
Well, it's just a church. It smells inside and it smells outside and it's got bodies all around it.
What religion?
It's just a church. It's got bodies all around it. It's planted in the middle of bodies. You've got to walk through dead bodies to get in. And then they give you bits of somebody's dead body if you're old enough. And then you've got to walk out through dead bodies. And then they say, I am the resurrection and the life. And it seems to me a load of...
I like how they cut it out at the end there. So she must be describing walking through a graveyard to get to the church. This is the life of this young boy, Charlie. He's basically a beggar. He's a street urchin. His mother had passed away and his father had died from something, and he is basically left to the streets. He was eventually sent to some kind of home, some kind of orphanage.
A poor house, basically.
Yeah, a poor house. And in this next regression audio, he's 12 years old, and Sue Atkins, who is the woman in the current age in the 1970s, she relives through Charlie how they seem to be playing with fire in the room. And this ultimately leads to the screaming that we heard from the very first recording. And you'll hear that he describes, or she describes, the door being locked, and you can sense the real urgency as it starts to dawn on this child that there's no escape. Let's take a listen.
Charlie, who was badly crippled, was taken to the workhouse when his mother died. Here, aged about 12, he was burned to death when the floor of the children's sleeping room caught fire as they were cooking a dead sparrow over a pile of embers.
Hey!
What will happen then?
The fire's big. The fire's getting big, is it?
It's warm. Yeah. Is the door locked?
She locks us in.
No, she wouldn't get us in the morning if she didn't lock us in.
And it's night now, is it?
She'll see the fire, I think. She's going to see the fire, you know, because it's going to show under the door. She's going to see the fire, you know. She will. She'll see it.
If you put the mattress on, is it pretty tight? Put the mattress on it. Put the other one on it. Put more on it!
Get out of the way, then. Get out of the way, then.
Be fast!
Drift off to sleep.
I can't move.
Off to sleep.
I can't move.
Off to sleep.
No.
Sleep, boy. Sleep, boy. Sleep, boy. Off to sleep. Off to sleep.
So that's Joe Keaton there saying off to sleep, and that's a code word to bring Sue Atkins out of that hypnotic state, because the trauma of reliving being burnt alive is clearly too visceral. It's too real.
So it sounds like they were trying to, because they're in a poor house, they were trying to cook something, the sparrow in that case, and then the fire got too large. And it's kind of funny how, because if you describe a house burning down, I think as an adult who's making something up, you're probably inclined to do it in a different way, right? But the fact that this kid is kind of describing that, well, the best way to hide the fire is to throw a bag of straw on it, and then that's not enough, so they keep on throwing more. She's saying throw, but of course a kid would think that way, right? A kid would think that's the best way to suffocate a fire, not realizing that you're throwing combustible material on top of a raging fire.
And you can also hear that the boy's reassuring himself that the lady that keeps the house is going to see the fire from under the door because the door's locked. Mm. Surely she's going to see it. She's going to see it. She must be able to see it. But remember, Sue Atkins, in her regression sessions, she wasn't just this boy, Charlie. She also regressed all the way back to the 17th century and took on a completely different personality to this young boy, this young street urchin. She became Father Anthony. I'll let the author tell the story here and we'll pick up the regression on Father Anthony's deathbed. Let's take a listen.
Sue Atkins' other character, Anthony Charles Bennett, was the opposite of Charlie in every way. He was born about 1640 into a wealthy Catholic family in East Anglia. Even as a small boy, he was deeply pious and described with delight how their priest said Mass secretly in the middle of the night. But instead of returning to England as he'd hoped, he was sent to France. Even if he was not happy there, he still showed the same dedicated obedience. In his late 30s, Father Anthony returned to England, but taken to the age of 43, he had apparently had a severe stroke and was dying.
Do you feel, Father, that you will ever recover and say Mass again?
No.
Have you any fears about the future?
No.
What do you think will happen to you?
God will take me.
God will take
I pray you. God will take me.
And do you think that will be the end of you?
Oh, no. It'll be the beginning.
At this stage of the regression, with this very pious Father Anthony on his deathbed, the authors and the regression therapists ask a really intriguing question of who are we? Who are we to you?
That's actually a really good question. I hadn't thought of that.
Let's take a listen.
Who are we? Father Anthony. Who are we?
Messengers.
Messengers from where?
I have a lot of messengers now.
Where from?
Especially in the night when I can't sleep. God. Must be God. It can't be the devil. It's God. It must be God. It must be God.
So it's intriguing there that this personality, this previous life, is on their deathbed saying, the messengers come to me in the night. And the hypnotherapists who are asking the questions are also the messengers.
It's so strange because there's a new book from Dr. Penny Sartori coming out pretty soon, which I'm going to pick up a copy and I'll see if I can get her on the show. But a link was sent to me, I was also pointing
Penny Sartori's the near-death experience
That's right.
researcher, right?
Yeah, yeah. And she's published a couple of books, or at least one in the past about the near-death experience. But I think she was a hospice worker. And at some point, and that pointed me in the direction of these hospice workers that have had experiences, and many of them are very skeptical, but one thing that seems to pop up in a recurring theme is that a large number, not just a small number, a large number of people as they're approaching the end of their life, maybe a day or so before, will start getting this terminal lucidity where they're communicating with something that's not there. Whether it's a loved one or someone who's passed over before, or they'll do the claims that they're getting ready to go take a trip or a journey. And I'd never thought of it before, but just listening to that audio, imagine if you're there in one existence and you're approaching terminal lucidity and you're about to pass on. Somehow, it's not just communicating with people that are from the other side, but imagine in a future lifetime, you've got some people running a regression and they're coming through. That sounds like that's what is exactly is occurring here.
That's what it is.
Isn't it strange?
If you're on your deathbed and you start hearing voices, it's some future regression therapist from the year 3000 asking you what you're going through.
But it turns,
I'm dying!
Yeah, exactly. But it turns the entire thing on its head when you think about it, because if you're passing over, you think, well, you're only communicating with other people that have passed over or something which is almost supernatural. But for some reason, you may just be communicating with people in the future.
Yeah, it's
so
it's,
weird.
That's why I wanted to play it, because it's such a weird question to ask the memories of a previous incarnation, if that's what it is. Well, the next one I wanted to play was Edna Whedon, another English housewife, very posh lady who regressed to another kind of precocious little street urchin. And her first memory is being a five-year-old in the slums of London. It's really interesting because they're totally different characters. Let's take a listen.
Edna Whedon is a typical Lancashire housewife. But under hypnosis, she consistently takes on the personality of Nell Gwynn, the 17th century actress and mistress of Charles II. The real Nell spent her childhood in the squalid slums around Drury Lane in London. This is how Edna recreates the five-year-old Nell.
What's your father's name?
Thomas.
And what does he do?
He's not doing nothing now.
And what did he used to do?
My daddy told me he was a soldier.
Was he?
But he didn't get killed.
He didn't get killed?
Because he come home, so he didn't get killed.
Now, she kind of talks like a child in a way. Mm. She still has the Lancashire accent, but you also get a sense that she's talking the way a kind of Cockney London accent would sound like from a little, you know, homeless five-year-old in London. But you really get a sense of that when they progress her to the age of 7 and she's become this industrious little thing selling herring for a threepence. Let's take a listen.
For the next few years, the real Nell ran wild about the alleys growing coarse and obscene. One contemporary reported that she hawked fish to help the family income. This is how Edna reacted when told to come to the age of 7.
You're now 7 years old. Where are you now?
I'm selling bleeding fishes.
How much do you charge?
Threepence!
You don't sell many at threepence.
Fresh herrings, threepence!
Thank you, Helen. They stink, those herrings. Take them away from here. They're smelling the place out.
Do you want a fresh herring, lady? Have a fresh. Yes, they're fresh. I've just chopped the bleeding head off that one. She bought an herring for 3 pennies.
I really like that one. She just jumps straight into character and starts selling herrings for a threepence. And she's even kind of using the colloquialism or swearing for the time, saying I'm selling bleeding fish, innit?
I just got this impression of you coming through at a future life flogging plus.
That's what it'll be, yeah. And eventually she goes on to live a life on the stage, and there's this story where, she actually retells this in the audio, where a gentleman who it seems to fancy her bursts into her changing room. Let's take a listen.
In Edna's regressions, one of the names that crops up most frequently is that of Samuel Pepys, whom she always calls Pippi. In his diary, Pepys describes his passion for the actress Mary Knipp. On October the 5th, 1667, he writes, "Going to the King's Theatre met with Knipp, and she took us up into the changing rooms, where Nell was dressing herself and was all unready, and is very pretty.
I had a little room, you know, where I used to change. And he once came in and caught me in my chemise.
Yeah. That was nice for him.
You were a knight. I think you were looking for her then.
So I just included a little bit of audio there, but I thought that was important because it's such an obscure detail that this guy had written in his diary that he fancied some actress, and once he burst into her dressing room, and she's going through this regression, someone who has no interest in history and happens to know this little detail from this guy's diary.
Yeah, that's really compelling. And this is one thing I think that was put forward. I think there was only one review, but someone was saying that the problem with a lot of these experiences throughout this book is that they're very mundane. But I actually thought that's more evidence from my perspective, because when we did our past life regressions many years ago now, we did it with Marlene Nicholson-Smith, and she was fantastic. When we were talking with her, she made a really valid point that has always stuck with me. And she said that she has clients that come through and they're doing these past life regressions. But rather than it being, oh, well, I got up this morning and I got on the train and I went to work, these people are like, oh, I was a pink dolphin on the sparkly sea on a foreign land, and I was the Elizabeth Taylor of the Ming Dynasty. Like, makes good for show content. But the problem is that it makes it less believable.
Yeah,
like,
no one's regressing to being a pharaoh in this book. They're all, like you heard, they're basically...
Everyone ends up in Egypt.
...selling fish on the streets in London.
Yeah.
That's about as exciting as it gets. And as I was going through this, I thought it was funny because they were pointing out just how difficult it is to get really detailed answers from people as well. Especially in those first sessions, they have a transcript from this American businessman, and his audio was actually on some of the vinyl LPs, but for some reason the recording was just so bad it was basically unusable. But you can hear his accent switch from that American twang to an Irish accent, because he basically had this memory of starving and the great famine. But they have this transcripts of several minutes of questioning. And let me just read some of this for you, where Keaton's asking, have you any memories at all? Have you any memories? What can you remember? And very, very faintly he says, well, what can you remember? Tell us what you can remember. Very faintly he slurs, don't know. Well, you can see something, can't you? Come on, it doesn't matter how silly it seems. Tell us, what do you see? Lots of hats. Oh, lots of hats. Where are they? On heads. On the heads of whom?
How frustrating.
People. Yes, I know they're on the heads of people. What kind of hats are they? round hats. Where are you standing? Are you sitting or what? What's going on? Watching. Watching what? Where from? The street. What are you doing on the street? And then there's a really long pause. Standing.
Okay, so that's a little bit too mundane.
So that was really the challenge with this book, was to try and find the really juicy story in here. And I think there is one. It's from Thelma Palmer. And this was intriguing because when Keaton started to work, because mostly he had worked with English people, in a second part of the book, he started to work with some Americans, and they were wondering whether the past lives would go back to the old world. Because if you look at the English population, obviously it's been historically kind of static.
Yes.
But the American population is relatively new for Europeans.
Mm.
So they actually found this, that a lot of the past lives that were coming up did go back to the old world. Some of them went back to American or European settlers in the United States. But there was one where it was the case of, yeah, Thelma Palmer. She's this 50-year-old teacher and writer from Washington. And she had this vivid experience of going back to the 4th of July, 1776, for the Declaration of Independence. I mean, what a time to go back to. If you were going to pick any point in time as an American to go back to and witness,
that's where you'd want to be.
The Declaration of Independence. So the personality that came through was actually an old man named Tom Brown. And they were asking him, well, what's happening in your life? And he just kept on saying, independence, independence. Well, do you actually remember independence, they asked? Do you remember it happening? And he said, yes, yes. I remember people shouting and cheering. What did they shout? That the Americans would be free, he said. What else do you remember? What do you remember, any important people, they asked? Franklin and Adams and Jefferson, he said. So all these names and all the details started to come through, and it sounded like he may have actually been there, this personality. He describes the buildings of Philadelphia accurately. And yeah, this was really intriguing. They realized that this was a unique opportunity, especially because the subject they were working with, Thelma, had no interest in history at all.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that because, I mean, this example goes against what I was just saying about there being mundane cases. And this is obviously a very exciting case. But also, if someone has a fascination with the signing of the Declaration of Independence, they would have been able to look up that information and have it ready to go before they're doing the regression.
Well, not only was she not interested in history, she hadn't really traveled anywhere outside of Washington. I mean, she had just left the state on a business trip. I can't remember where she went, but she's never been to Philadelphia at all. She's never really traveled across the country. So just very, and it's intriguing because they say in the room for this particular session was a history expert who was from Philadelphia, and his bread and butter was this time period. I mean, he knew it back to front. So he was observing this regression. But they say this actually caused a problem because Thelma, and they say the experience is that your conscious mind is still observing what's going on, but then these memories start to surface and essentially take control of your vocabulary.
Mm.
Take control of your speech, and these memories start to surface and the questions are answered. But at the same time, her conscious memory is conflicting with this because she knows that she doesn't know history. She knows that she doesn't know any of this stuff. And she also doesn't want to make a fool of herself.
Yeah, so I'm sure there'd be a level of apprehension and anxiety as well coming through from the current incarnation.
She was, as this knowledge started to come through, she actually became embarrassed, she said afterwards. And what they had to do was move her forward to a different time.
In the same life or?
In the same life, or move her back or forward so that all these details on this significant historical event wouldn't cause that conflict with her conscious mind.
Yeah.
So the way it actually started was kind of amusing, where they said, well, what can you see? And she started to say, a door. Well, what color is the door? I'm afraid to open it, she said. Well, why? Where does the door lead? Into the kitchen. Or into whose kitchen? two people are waiting for me. So this is where slowly they started to figure out that she was actually regressing to a boy named Tom, 16 years old at the time. And she was starting to show anxiety on her face. So they could tell that for this 16-year-old Tom, this wasn't a fun time. And they asked, well, what's the matter, Tom? What do you think's on the other side of the door? And very tightly he said, there's two girls. Why are you afraid of the girls, Tom? Who are these two girls? And with this kind of frightened, twitching grin, he says, well, one's Suzette. How old is she? Well, she's 16 and the other's Jane. Why are you afraid to go into the kitchen then? And in this embarrassed tone, he says, well, I'm afraid they've found out. I saw Suzette behind the barn. Well, what was Suzette doing behind the barn? And in this really uneasy, embarrassed way, he says, and when I say he, it's really just Thelma lying there on the couch. Well, we were both there and I'm afraid Jane has found out. Jane's my friend. What country is this, Tom? Because this is one of the very first regressions. This is how the personality first came through. And it's funny because he's kind of huffy about the irrelevance of this question in the middle of this awkward moment of these memories coming through.
Mm.
So he's annoyed. He says, oh, the United States, of course. Well, how many states are there, they ask him. And he's like, 13, obviously. So this is where they start to figure out the time periods. Because if you know there's 13 states, you can put it between, well, they eventually figure out between 1776 and 1790. And Thelma's really not happy about this, the woman from Washington.
Because, what, she's a little bit embarrassed about whatever is occurring here?
Yeah, again, she's embarrassed. She knows there's an expert there. She doesn't really know if she believes in any of this stuff. She doesn't know where these memories are coming from.
But why is the kid involved? Like, what's the kid embarrassed about? The kid appears to be embarrassed.
Okay, well, they continue with this opening regression and say, well, Tom, what are you doing? And very quietly, they get the answer, it's not what I'm doing. Well, what's Suzette doing then? And he coyly says, well, she's putting my hands on her waist. What are you doing? I'm not doing much. And then he's like, oh, Suzette, what will happen if Jane finds out, Tom? Oh, no, we're rolling in the hay. Oh, Suzette, no. Don't what, Tom? What are you talking about? She's kissing me and more, he says. So you can picture the situation. Again, this just lovely woman from Washington who has no interest in any of this is reliving this rompy pompy in the hay behind the barn in the 1700s.
It's crazy.
Not knowing what's going on.
And it sounds like he's cheating or he's deceiving someone else.
So I'll explain that in a moment. But Moss points out that there's absolutely no doubt that Thelma had abandoned her own personality and was actually Tom in his teens. And this broad outline of this boy's life quickly built up over their sessions. And they basically did 5 and 10 year steps until his death. But Tom said he'd been born in a settlement called Brownsville. It was 10 miles from Philadelphia. And there had always been an understood arrangement that he would marry Jane. So remember, he's rolling around in the hay with Suzette.
Oh, I see, yeah.
And initially he's terrified to go through this door because he knows that Suzette and Jane are on the other side. Now he's always agreed to marry Jane, but he's getting around with that whore, Suzette. This is a problem. So he's, willingly seduced by Suzette. And then eventually they learn at 20, he went to be a printer in Philadelphia because his family thought he should have a trade. There was a short spell where he was a lusty lad in the capital city and he describes paying a shilling for a prostitute. And again, Thelma, the lovely lady from Washington, is basically saying, well, it's a lot of money, but she was worth it because she was a hell of a whore.
Oh my God. It's all
dirty stuff in this regression. And they're saying that Tom may have lived from about the late 1760s until the 1850s. But something strange happened in the regression that seemed to link this old incarnation of Tom to the current life of Thelma.
How?
Well, let me go back to the transcript and I'll explain. They're asking, where are you, Tom? And all of a sudden he seems very weak, very sick. And barely audibly he says, I'm upstairs. And he's gasping for breath all of a sudden, or Thelma is on the hypnotic couch. Where are you, Tom? Very faintly he's saying, thirsty, thirsty. And they said that all of a sudden Thelma's mouth is dry, her lips are parched, and she's licking her lips. Are you ill? They ask. Well, they get no answer from him. So what they try and do is they bring Tom forward several months where he appears to be better. He's content and fishing on the banks of a small stream near the home. And in reply to a question they put towards him, all he'll really say is that he caught three trout, he's really happy, and that he's been reading Shakespeare, specifically Hamlet. Now, no matter what they try and ask, all he wants to talk about is Shakespeare and Hamlet. So they ask him, why do you keep mentioning Hamlet? Why don't you read any of Shakespeare's other plays? And as soon as they ask this question, Thelma starts freaking out. And the personality of Tom becomes incredibly distressed. Now, it's strange because Joe Keaton, the hypnotist, he gets a sense that although they've tried to take the personality forward in time to when he was better, he's not actually better. He's in a delirious state.
What, from fever or
yeah, he's in
else?
Some delirious state, but still ill. Him fishing on the banks and catching trout is some kind of...
Oh, it's like a delirium. Fever dream.
It's like a fever dream, exactly. But when they specifically ask, what is it about Hamlet, he starts freaking out. And they're saying, what's the matter, Tom? What's the matter? Why are you so upset? And he's absolutely terrified and really strained. He starts saying, there's a well. Well, where is it, Tom? Absolutely terrified. He says, I don't know. What are you doing there? And at this stage, Thelma's gasping and out of control. And I really wish they included this in the audio recordings, but it's just not in there. He says, I don't know. And he starts basically crying, breaking down. Why are you so frightened, Tom? They ask. Tell us what's happening. And he says, I see myself, but it's not me. Who is it then? I don't know. The eyes are dark. Ah! Is it a man or a woman? Who can you see, Tom? It's a man, I think. Where is he? He's in the well. And he starts breaking down. He starts crying. What's he doing in the well, Tom? He's looking at me. Is he swimming? No. How deep is the well? 20 feet, he says. 20 feet. The moon. He's suddenly hysterical. The moon. The moon is in the well and the face is in the well. Is the person alive, Tom? No, he says, and he suddenly starts shouting, Hamlet! Hamlet! Now, the anguish and the fear and the distress that this personality is showing, but also the physical distress they're seeing in Thelma under aggression, is so much that essentially they bring Tom forward to the age of 21, where he's instantly calm and describes in a flat, unemotional tone the daily routine on his farm. It's like this crazy moment of fear has passed. Now, from some of the things that had come up in different sessions, they thought that maybe this would be connected to Suzette, the girl that he had sex with behind the barn. And they thought this because whenever they asked him about her, the personality Tom was very cagey. He would say things like, she's gone away, I don't know where she went, or she went away with a soldier, or she went to Salem. They could never really get a straight answer. And it was almost as if Tom became more and more abstract, as if something was preying on his mind, they said. And when he became silent altogether, he was immediately put into a deep sleep and told to bring out whatever was worrying him. And immediately, Thelma on the couch starts becoming frantic, and the personality Tom starts talking about the well again. The well, he said. What is it about the well, Tom? And he's crying at this stage, just bawling his eyes out. It's several minutes before they can get a straight answer. Tom, who was in the well? And heartbrokenly, he says, Suzette was in the well. How did she get in the well, Tom? And the whole time I'm thinking he murdered her.
Yeah, me too. That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
He says, she threw herself in. She's gone. She's gone. And he sobs uncontrollably until they take Thelma out of the hypnotic state. So ultimately we learn that after they had had sex, eventually Suzette became pregnant and her parents had thrown her out. And Tom, in this ultimate moment of, you know, taking responsibility for what had happened, he had, despite his commitment to Jane, he was going to marry Suzette. He had made up his mind and he was going to propose to her. But before he could, she had thrown herself into the well and committed suicide.
Oh.
Before he had a chance to propose.
So where did the Hamlet come in? Was that just...
Well, get this. Going back to the modern day with Thelma, the woman that's being regressed, she claims that in 1972, a week after her father died, she received this strange letter in the mail, which had been posted from Philadelphia, which is where this previous life of Tom was. And she had no acquaintance in Philadelphia. She knew no one in Philadelphia, didn't have any friends there, no family connections. So she opens this strange letter and the handwriting is unmistakably her father's. It has to be her father's handwriting. And it's a single sheet of paper that says this: Thelma is Hamlet rearranged, a well-wisher.
Oh, how bizarre that is. But so is her father passed on?
Her father was dead. So they, to this day, they say they have no idea who sent the letter. They don't know how it came to her. It just came from Philadelphia with that line on it in her father's handwriting.
Is she absolutely certain that it's her father's handwriting?
Well, I guess you can't be 100% certain, but she swears it's her father's handwriting. But what is this connection to Hamlet? And if you look at it, Hamlet is, I mean, Thelma spelt in a different way. It's like an anagram.
So, yeah, it's so weird. So I wonder if that suggests on some level, I don't know how you'd ever be able to prove it or track it, that every single ego, every single incarnation, maybe there's some kind of nod to the previous one or some type of connection moving through.
Well, who sent her the letter? I mean, one idea that came into my mind is that her father is on his deathbed and suddenly he has an understanding of some kind of karmic connection between the two of them. Maybe her father was Suzette, who drowned in the well.
Well, that is one thing that's suggested, is that people move through incarnations as soul groups. So you tend to be around the same sort of people, but as incestuous as it sounds, it's not, because it's a new incarnation each time.
Yeah,
but
of course. Yeah.
I mean, your wife may be your father in the next incarnation, and then it might be your son in the next one, and then you kind of owe debts to each other.
And in a moment of clarity on his deathbed, he leaves this cryptic message for his daughter.
It's just, the thing is about it, why it's so weird, is because if that letter had shown up at any other time, yeah, it would have been weird that she got a letter in her father's handwriting, but the fact that it was after this regression as well.
No, it was before the regression.
Oh, it was so before the regression.
He had died and this, she got this weird letter and just hung on to it.
Oh, prior to that.
And then 7 years later, she has the regression. And then finally they make the connection where this previous personality keeps mentioning Hamlet for some reason. So the other thing, of course, is that because she had received the letter prior to the regression.
Yeah, I was just thinking that.
It was in her subconscious somewhere. And this became melded with the personality of Tom that was coming through from the previous life. And it just happened to come in somehow.
It's certainly a possibility. But the fact is, it's still strange because it was a letter from her dead father. So it couldn't have been, because I was thinking it arrived after. So I was actually thinking that maybe someone who was part of that regression may have sent the letter and somehow tried to imitate the handwriting, which would have been hard enough as it is. But the fact that it arrived earlier, it's very strange. It's there's more to it, I think.
Well, they learn more about Tom's life and he ends up going to the city and he works under Benjamin Franklin. He becomes an apprentice for Benjamin Franklin. And they confirm all these incredible details. Like they confirm the building he worked on. And it's all these details that at first seem wrong, but it's one of those things where the researchers look into it. They go back to that expert who knew everything about the history and, you know, he confirms, oh no, actually she was right. Because one example was she said she had worked for Franklin on High Street at one of his printing presses. And when they looked it up, it was actually Market Street. So they thought that was the detail was wrong. But the researchers said, well, if you look at the old maps, it actually was called High Street, but it's been changed to Market Street only in the late, you know, 19th century or something.
Little details like that, I mean, they're not proof. They certainly are good evidence.
Well, she describes when the currency switched over to the dollar. She describes accurately the mint being set up in Philadelphia. You know, and it's nothing that you couldn't really look up if you were really dedicated at research in the 1970s. But again, this was just a random woman who had no interest in history, no idea about the history of Benjamin Franklin or any of this stuff.
Well, it was a different...
Being able to confirm these details.
Yeah, and it was a different, you know, world in the 1970s. I mean, yeah, there were people looking for fame, but in reality, it's not like it is today. I mean, would you really go to that kind of effort to do all that research just to fake a previous incarnation and then hope that it would do something for you? What, is it going to make you famous because you've proven reincarnation?
Not for some random book.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
that
exactly.
No one knows about.
Yeah. So I think you can't completely rule it out, but I think that reduces the possibility of a fraud like that occurring.
So that was about the most interesting story in the whole thing.
But I like that. I think that's good. I mean, once again, not every single previous incarnation were you an Egyptian whore, you know, apparently as I was. Now, these are things that don't, yeah, when someone's having a past life regression, as I said, it's fun to hear the crazy stories, but in reality, most of us in each existence, I believe, live pretty normal lives.
I like the Egyptian whore stories. They're really good.
You know what, actually? I was told that well after we'd had those past life regressions. So maybe now we should go back and see if we can get me back under. Maybe we could find out what happened.
Let's do it.
I can't believe I just signed up for that.
You'll just be an accountant or something in the 80s.
Yeah, probably.
No, you were alive in the 80s. That doesn't work.
Well, apparently you only, I mean, some of the things I've heard, you reincarnate every 70 years or so. So we'll go back. We'll go back and see.
Why do you say that, 70 years?
Where did I hear it? I heard it from, I don't know.
It's really weird you said that, because in between the death of Tom and the incarnation of Thelma is 70 years. Exactly. So there's a 70-year gap.
Really?
So what the researchers question at the end is there another incarnation that they couldn't get to in between the two?
I can't remember who said, I was talking to a clairvoyant or someone somewhere, and I remember them saying it's like about 70 years between each incarnation, which kind of puts apparently enough distance in for the soul to, you know, recuperate and learn its lessons and come back.
That's pretty weird.
I can't believe you had that ready to go. Wow. But can I just throw my little gold Buddha story?
Let's take a break.
Yeah, okay, we'll do that.
We've got more coming up after this on Mysterious Universe, including the tale of the golden Buddha. Stay with us.
Before we finish up the show or go into our plus segment where we're going to be discussing Yamashita's gold, I just wanted to give you a little taste of just how complex this entire story is and just how crazy it is. Because ultimately, it's really funny how I went through the book, because it seems like it's like an old fairy tale about how greed leads to the destruction of everything. And this is truly what this is. So in the plus extension, I'm going to go into how the Japanese plundered all of this gold and how they processed it and how it eventually ended up in the Philippines and then in black ops projects ultimately in the end.
Ooh.
But before I get there, I just want to tell this little story of a guy by the name of Rogelio Rojas, or is also known as Roger Rojas. And he was this locksmith who was in the Philippines, and he was not a peasant, but he had a meager living. But he also happened to be the head of the local treasure hunters guild or group. And the reason why these little groups were set up is because there was all these legends and stories about Yamashita's gold, about how the Japanese had stolen all of this gold and antiquities and everything else from all over Asia, that gotten it to the Philippines and had shoved it into these 172 underground vaults. And so there were little clubs that popped up everywhere that were trying to find these things. But the Japanese went to such precise detail in recreating entire mountainsides that these things were almost impossible to find. And unless you had a map, these very intricate maps, which I'll explain later, you weren't able to get your way into any of these vaults or into these little mines that had been covered over. But this guy, Rojas, really wasn't going to let up. And this story came to him through his treasure hunting. So it was the 1970s, it was 1971. And so the war had been over for 30 or so years, but in saying that, there were still people in living memory, there were people that all were alive, that had seen activity going on and Japanese activities. And as much as the Japanese army and the leaders had done everything they could to eliminate witnesses, there still were people around. And this story came to Rojas about there being just outside a hospital, which also happened to be during the war, General Yamashita's headquarters, that there was some gold and other treasures that were hidden near this hospital. And so he went digging and he dug and he dug and he dug and he couldn't find anything near this hospital, but people were claiming that it was there. Until one day it came to him that there was an old pillbox that was there that was set up for Gunner's duty or whatever else. And as he was just digging around, he managed to fall through the floor and this floor that had been constructed into this tunnel.
Oh.
And when he came into this tunnel, he found that he looks up and he lights a match, something like out of Indiana Jones, and he can see all of these treasures all around. And there's all this glittering gold and there's all these bars. And the bars were created in these prism type of fashion. And when they're all put together, they'll put opposite sides. So they kind of all
perfectly stacked.
Yeah, perfectly stacked and interlinked into each other. And there were boxes and there were, you know, there was all these antiquities that were there. And he looks up and there is this prize. What it's really the prize of this whole experience, because it's a 1-ton Buddha statue, solid gold.
Oh my gosh.
That's sitting before him. It's just sitting there. And it's distinctly Burmese. It's distinctly Burmese style Buddha. And the investigations revealed that it was actually stolen from Mandalay. And it was hidden in Yamashita's because he apparently wanted it to be as close as possible. And so what he did is he realized, look, as much as this border is cool, what he could do was actually get the border out, sell the border or find someone to sell the border to, and then use that to fund the rest of the extraction of all the gold bars.
How does he move a 1-ton golden Buddha statue?
He gets, because he's got other treasure hunters with him, not many, but he gets like this A-frame and he rigs it up. And surprisingly, 1 ton of gold is not as big as you would think because gold is quite dense.
Yeah.
So this thing was about 3 foot tall. But still 1 ton. So it's not huge, but it's obviously very heavy and worth a lot of money. Now, back then, I think the price of gold was somewhere in the range of, I think it was before it hit about 300 to 400 an ounce, somewhere in that range. So still a lot of money. Today.
Millions and millions and millions.
And not only that, because of the way that this thing was created, it's also the value of the cultural aspect as well. So he managed to pull this Buddha out. Don't know how, but using this A-frame, and he got the Buddha out, he dragged it home and then shoved a mattress over it and covered it and kept it in his home. Now, when he kept it in his home, he kept on having people to come around and visit his home, potential people that he was going to sell it to. But this was not such a good idea, because even though he had found this thing, there were people in the government, when I say people in the government, the very president of the Philippines, that wanted to get their hands on that gold and on that Buddha. And so a couple of people came and word started getting out that this Buddha, this golden Buddha was real. They came and they did assays. So what they did is there were some men that came and drilled into the back of this thing. When they drilled, they took out just little dust samples, did an assay and found that it was 22 carats, which was consistent with what the gold was at the time. So this wasn't a fake statue. He had really pulled out this full solid gold statue. And then a couple of guys showed up. And when they showed up, they kept on looking at the neck. And they kept on playing and just like tapping on the neck. And he thought it was really strange. And like, we'll get back to you. And they left. But you could tell that there was something not right about these guys. And I would say that it's probably likely that these guys were government informants or whatever else. But because they were so fascinated with the neck, he wanted to work out why. So he jumped up and started playing with the head of this Buddha. until it clicked off.
Oh.
He pulls it back and he looks down inside and he thinks that there's a whole heap of glass in there. It's diamonds.
What?
It's full of diamonds.
Oh my gosh.
So he pulls all the diamonds out and goes and hides them somewhere else and puts the head back on and clicks it in. And pretty soon after that, I mean, it was really smart of him to pull the diamonds out and hide them, but pretty soon after that, government agents with machine guns kick the door in and say that they are taking this Buddha. And they confiscate it. The Buddha's gone. Now, Rojas, being a, he doesn't like the government, is the least to say. So what he does is he stands up to them. He immediately goes to the authorities. And the authorities say, look, it's not a good idea. It's gone. Just let it go. And he's like, no, I'm not going to. They say, look, they politely say, if you persist with this, it's likely that you're going to be killed.
Wait, so did the state take it or was it just people with machine guns? It was actually confiscated by the,
well, the
Filipino
is,
state?
Right. The thing is that he was told that it was confiscated by the local authorities and the authorities were taking it because of antiquity reasons and it was not his in the first place. When he went to the court to find out what was going on, the court had no knowledge of it whatsoever.
Right.
But it wasn't robbers. It was the president of the Philippines.
What?
Marcos had...
Personally.
No, not personally. But he had found out about this. And this guy was a ruthless bastard. And I will describe more details about him later as well. And he really was an absolute scumbag. But completely obsessed with hanging on to wealth and flaunting it. Like, he wanted to be up there with the Rothschilds. And he had to flaunt this wealth. And he already was a rich man. But he wanted more. And he knew all about these stories about Yamashita's gold and was doing everything he could to get hold of it. So what had happened was the police had said to him, look, if you sign an affidavit or a complaint, it's likely that you're going to be killed. And Rojas says, I don't care. And he signs this thing.
Really?
He signs it. Now, when he signs it, essentially he's arrested straight away. And he starts to be threatened. And there's all of this threatening. He's tortured. And these government agents connected to President Marcos come in and torture him. And he doesn't give up. He refuses to give up. He just will not bow down to this guy and give away the details of where the remainder of all this gold is. And so this is going until finally they release him. And then, of course, he's arrested again. And it's this ongoing saga that happens and he's released. But finally, there's this, there's almost like people are starting to get ticked off with his presidency wasn't good anyway, but the end of the democracy really came about because of this Buddha. Because there was an opposition rally that was protesting against Marcos's rule. And Marcos actually threw grenades into the crowd and killed 10 people. Well, he didn't, but he had people do it for him. But he immediately blamed the communists and then declared martial law. Once habeas corpus was suspended, Marcos could do whatever the hell he wanted. So his grip tightened around his complete control. And this is when he sent soldiers in everywhere trying to find this. And of course, they recaptured Rojas and tortured him again. Rojas is just this real badass. Like, he just wouldn't give up. So what they did is they went to one of the people that were involved in helping him pull it out.
Yeah, that's what I thought. Out. If he had pulled out the original one-ton Buddha, surely other people would know the location of the hoard.
They went to one of his digging, the member of his digging team, and they pulled out his teeth one by one with pliers, without anesthetic, until finally he relented. And then with that, Marcos discovered the treasure, the vault, and then he extracted 10,000 gold bars from the tunnels, worth even back then tens of billions of dollars. But the story of Marcos doesn't end there. And the story of Rojas, how ultimately he gets Marcos back, continues well into 1996.
What?
So there's this long saga where ultimately it seems like greed finally comes back to haunt Marcos, which of course I will reveal in the Plus extension coming up very soon.
The edge of my seat is firmly entering my buttocks.
Look, I'm shocked by this story. There is so much. In fact, the book is incredibly dense, so I'm not going to lie about that. There's a lot of content in here. But ultimately, what I'm going to be describing is not only this lesson of revenge, the end of democracy in the Philippines, and the destruction of many people's lives, but also how a clandestine agency is now utilizing that money for purposes of still being the controlling hand behind a lot of the global banks and the International Monetary Fund. Just complete. I mean, I'm Alex Jones. You call me Aaron Jones. That's where I am now.
Is there light speed escalators?
There's no light speed escalators, unfortunately. But I'm also to go into some of the details of how the Japanese created these places, and some of them are so incredibly sophisticated that they're still there, and some of them haven't been discovered. Just ripe for picking with all of this gold inside.
I don't think I'm going to have time for my 14th century robot tulpa story in plus.
Well, we'll see how we go.
Just before we go, I wanted to just make give a quick update on our call-in line. I discovered this afternoon that there's been some changes on Skype, and anyone calling in, you won't be able to leave a message longer than 2 minutes. This is just how Skype operates now.
If you Google it, people are complaining about it, but Skype's like, oh, it should be 10 minutes.
Yeah, I don't think they're going to change it. No. So essentially that's the end of that call-in line for now. So if you've left a message and you're getting cut off, I'm really sorry, but there's really nothing we can do about it.
We'll come up with another solution though, so don't panic.
And it's happening on both our Skype ID and the call-in number. They both go to Skype, so there's no point on keeping it if it's only 2 minutes, because there's been some great stories, but people are getting cut off. Like, I was listening to a guy this afternoon who went to see a shaman in Peru, and the shaman predicted that he was going to get sick and be in hospital for months. And then he said, yeah, okay, whatever. And then a couple of years later, he had stage 4 cancer and managed to overcome it. But it was this warning from the shaman, and it was this great story, but then it was cut off after 2 minutes. And I never got to hear the end of it.
So we're back to suspense.
Yeah, suspense pretty much. I was really a lot of suspense, but never got to hear the answer because of this dumb Skype thing.
Right, we'll fix it.
I'm looking into other avenues for the call-in line, other services we can use, because I want to bring it back. I want to hear your calls. We love getting your calls on the show. So just keep in mind that that's got a limit of 2 minutes at the moment. Yeah. And also, if you have a support question, if you're a Plus member and you want support, you should email us at support@mysteriousuniverse.org. If you leave us a message on Skype for a support issue, we just won't get to it.
Yeah. And also on Facebook as well and Twitter, guys, we can't help you because we might need to discuss personal financial information or whatever else. We don't really want to do that on public social media. So just shoot an email to support@mysteriousuniverse.org and we'll handle any problem you might have. Yeah. Not that problems occur when you're on Mysterious Universe Plus, Ben.
Well, no, that's just the quickest way you'll get to it, because we have staff that monitor the email address every single day, whereas Twitter, we're not always looking at Twitter and Facebook every day.
What a week we had. So we have a very lovely staff member who is working out of the Philippines.
Yeah, speaking of the Philippines.
Yeah, and Floor emails us on Monday morning and she says, oh, guys, do you mind can I keep working for you? I'm like, of course you can. I didn't think you weren't going to. Apparently she went into work, this massive building and call center. It's all gone.
Yeah,
just shut down.
Shutters down. No one's getting paid.
Yeah.
The CEO's disappeared.
Disappeared. You can't call them. You can't find them. Just completely up and disappeared. So there was a little delay in support, but Flora's back on it. She works for us now and everything's moving along nicely. I just don't understand it.
Well, they changed ownership a couple of months ago. So obviously the new owners cleaned it out and left.
Like Yamashita's gold. Yeah. They got in there, took everything they want and left.
Well, Yamashita's gold is coming up after the break for our Plus members. If you want to get access to that, you know the drill. Head to mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. All the details are there. You get the big extensions we do on the end of these shows every single Friday. And you get an exclusive show every single Tuesday as well. You're getting more than double the content if you sign up for Plus. In addition to the extra shows, you get a higher bitrate feed. We do a 320 kilobits per second feed for our members. You get all the ads stripped out of the show. The show's totally ad-free for you. You get discounts on our store. We still have a 50% off discount on our back catalog. And you get all the features of our apps unlocked for you as well. Again, $9 a month, mysteriousuniverse.org/plus. It's the best way to support the show and keep us going. Can't wait for the Yamashita stuff coming up after the break. We might sneak in some Tulpa robots towards the end. And I do have an old story about Dion Fortune and a cursed Buddha statue to go with your Yamashita stuff.
Oh, perfect.
So amazing stuff coming up for our Plus members. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Thanks for listening. Don't forget to check out the website, mysteriousuniverse.org. Look for season 18, episode 12. We'll list everything we've spoken about today, including the book Encounters with the Past. That's a wrap for this free edition of MU. Catch you next week. For everyone on Plus, stick around for the great stuff after the break. Welcome back to your Plus Extension. Great to have you with us. Strap in for the tales of Yamashita's goo.
Oh, wow, that is totally
Yamashita's
inappropriate. You know what?